What zero tolerance means for one family today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration has a zero tolerance policy for unauthorized migrants at the border. Today we hear from one mother who was separated from her child as a result.
Magdalena says when two women came for her daughter, they gave her a teddy bear and she was gone. Maria told me she used the teddy bear to wipe her tears.
And we hear why critics want that policy to change.
They created an orphan when they took the mother away.
Plus, a soccer match between Argentina and Israel is canceled after protests over the venue of Jerusalem.
This match, which could have been a nice thing, was mishandled by everybody involved.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us today. We start things off with a story that we've been following closely on the show. I'm talking about the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy toward migrant families at the border. That policy boils down to this. If a family crosses into the U.S. without authorization, they could end up separated from each other, criminally prosecuted, and face deportation. For our first segment on the show today, we'll meet one family directly affected by this policy. Reporter Ashley Cleek begins with a young girl now living in Florida, thousands of miles away from her mom. And a quick note here, we're only using the first names of the mother and daughter in order to protect the child's identity.
Maria was 6 years old when she was separated from her mom. It was at the border near El Paso, Texas.
I didn't understand them. I kept saying, And then when they took my mom, I got scared and just didn't understand anything.
Maria speaks Acateco, a Mayan language. She says she was confused, and so was her mom, Magdalena. After crossing the border, they spent 2 nights in custody together. Then, Magdalena was told she'd be put in jail, and her daughter would go elsewhere. Magdalena says when two women came for her daughter, they gave her a teddy bear, and she was gone. She wasn't told where or when she'd see her kid again. Maria, along with 3 other children, was flown to a shelter 2,000 miles away in upstate New York.
Mama, poquito.
Maria told me she used the teddy bear to wipe her tears. In May, California Senator Kamala Harris asked Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen about the Trump administration's new policy to separate families crossing the border illegally.
Your agency will be separating children from their parents.
What we'll be doing is prosecuting parents who've broken the law, just as we do every day in the United States of America.
I can appreciate that. But if that parent has a 4-year-old child, what do you plan on doing with that child?
The child under law goes to HHS for care and custody.
They will be separated from their parent.
Just like we do in the United States every day.
The family in this story, though, they were separated last August as the administration piloted this new policy. Earlier in 2017, John Kelly, the previous Homeland Secretary, said that separating families would deter illegal immigration. Immigration advocates say it's a tactic that ignores the real danger many migrants are escaping. And
they created an orphan when they took the mother away. Little Maria and her mother should have been given the opportunity not only to stay together, but to apply for asylum.
Angelina Castro is a lawyer working to get Maria, the daughter, asylum in the U.S. She says the mother and daughter should have been able to ask for asylum together at the border, because of domestic violence. In Guatemala, the family picked coffee beans. And Maria remembers her stepdad hitting and threatening her mom.
She would bleed from her face. The man would be drunk and he would hit her.
Maria also remembers when her stepdad came to the house with a gun, making threats. After that, Maria and her mom fled. Magdalena, the mom, says she told border officials that she feared returning to Guatemala, but none of this shows up in her paperwork or court records, just that she declined asylum. The Departments of Health and Human Services and Homeland Security provided no additional information about Magdalena's case, and there was no response to questions about the impact of this new policy on children. In January, after 5 months in detention, Magdalena was deported to Guatemala.
Magdalena?
I asked Magdalena what happened in detention. Did she ask for asylum? She says a judge told her she needed a lawyer, but immigrants facing deportation aren't appointed lawyers, and Magdalena couldn't afford one. She says the judge told her it'd be best to go back to Guatemala. Immigration lawyers say this part of the story isn't unusual. The immigration system is confusing, especially in another language and without an attorney. Jennifer Podkul is with Kids in Need of Defense, a nonprofit that works with migrant children. She says she's seen many migrants give up and agree to deportation.
Because of the strain of detention and being separated from their child, even if they have a legitimate case.
But what also worries her now is the kids separated from their parents, lingering in shelters until someone claims them. Hundreds of kids were taken from their parents at the border in May alone.
I think this administration has manufactured a crisis at the border that's going to force the system to implode.
Immigration advocates say this new policy also leaves parents and kids lost from one another. Magdalena says that while she was detained in Texas, she wrote letters to immigration to find out where her daughter was. She says it took weeks before she was able to speak to Maria on the phone. Today, Maria lives with her great aunt in Florida after spending more than 3 months in a shelter in New York State. When we meet, Maria is wearing purple leggings and a rainbow t-shirt. She pulls out a tub of crayons and flips through her notebook, filled with drawings of her family.
Mom, Maria.
Is this you?
Yeah. That one, my mommy. Mommy.
Her great aunt is a single mom with four kids. She's trying to get a green card, but doesn't have one yet. So we're not using her name since her status is uncertain. At first, the great aunt says, she was scared to sponsor Maria. After Trump's election, immigration agencies announced that in an effort to crack down on human trafficking, they would be more closely scrutinizing the relatives who take in migrant children.
I don't want to get in problems with immigration. I wasn't born here.
She said the Office of Refugee Resettlement told her that if she didn't sponsor Maria, the little girl would be put in permanent foster care or given to another family. So the great aunt sent in her paperwork.
But I know with the love of God, I responded for Maria because I had to. And now she's like a child of mine and I'll treat her like one of my kids.
When Maria got to Florida, her great aunt bought her a baby doll. Maria wrapped it in a sling and carried it on her back, like some moms do in Guatemala. Maria and her great aunt are really close. They make tortillas together and sing almost every evening in a church choir. The family's plan is to have Maria stay in Florida. Her mom, Magdalena, agrees. Magdalena says Maria's safer there and can finish school. As for Magdalena, when she was deported, she was warned that she couldn't come back to the U.S. for 10 years. If she tried to cross again, she could be charged with a felony. Magdalena thinks the policy of separating families at the border will scare some people away, but not her. She's terrified of being back in Guatemala, that the same man she fled from before will find her and kill her. Magdalena says she'll find a way to leave again and be with her daughter. For The World, Ashley Cleek, Florida.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from a woman who fled El Salvador because of domestic violence. She's still in the U.S., but her future here is getting murkier. Plus, we'll speak with a supporter of the president's immigration crackdown. Whoever said it's only a game has clearly never tried to play soccer in the Middle East. For example, a friendly soccer match between Argentina and Israel that was scheduled for this weekend in Israel was canceled today after the match drew protests from Palestinians and pro-Palestinian activists. In Barcelona, where the Argentine national team was practicing, protesters showed up wearing what looked like Argentina jerseys soaked in blood. Argentine soccer officials canceled the match in Israel, citing security. But Jerusalem-based reporter Noga Tarnopolsky says there's a lot more to the story.
I have to tell you that I think, in my estimation, this match, which could have been a nice thing, was mishandled in about the worst possible way by everybody involved.
What was the first moment of mishandling, would you say?
So the match was originally scheduled for the city of Haifa. That is a pretty calm kind of academic slash workers city up in the north of Israel. And the Israeli Minister of Culture and Sport, who is a real hard right winger called Miri Regev and who loves publicity, decided to very publicly move the match to Jerusalem, which this year, because of President Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, has become even more of a hotspot than it usually is. And she made a very big deal, basically in the star player's name, in Leo Messi's name, saying she was going to take him to the Western Wall in the Old City. She was going to shake his hand. And then her counterpart on the Palestinian side, who is the head of the Palestinian Football Union, and he's as much of a kind of showboat, let's say, as she is. I mean, they really are a match. His name is Jibril Rajoub. And he decided to take this protest really all the way. So he made a video that went up yesterday or the day before in which he's seen setting a T-shirt, looks like a shirt from Messi's back, on fire. He called on all Arabs around the world to set Argentine flags on fire and team shirts on fire. So you have people on both sides basically trying to turn this, I think, into a kind of a self-publicity tour.
Is that when they canceled the game? When did that actually get announced?
The cancellation was actually formally announced today, but apparently there were negotiations until the very last minute. I have to say, another person who doesn't come off well in this story is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who made an extremely flat-footed mistake. He called Argentine President Mauricio Macri in the middle of the night, apparently twice, to Wow. try and get him to intervene. Right, but it's like, I don't know what to compare it to, but the president of Argentina does not have any power over the Football Federation. It's an independent federation, and Netanyahu came off as both, I would say, a bit desperate and very clumsy.
I'm curious, if Donald Trump hadn't moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, would Israel Sports Minister Miri Regev have taken such a grandstand on this match?
It's hard for me to answer you because she's a grandstander. So I don't know. But that said, this government, the Netanyahu government, and in particular ministers like Ms. Regev, who try and push Netanyahu always more to the right, feel that they have a carte blanche from Trump to do and say whatever they want. And they're really running with it.
Noga, at a cultural level, how important was this match for Israel? How big a deal is Messi, not just for Israelis, but also for Palestinians?
Huge. It's hard for me to overstate it. There were kids on the street crying today, and their grandfathers who bought them tickets. And it's a major melodrama in Israel. It's a melodrama because he's such a hero. And also, the Israeli government turned this into a kind of sine qua non. The Israeli government turned this, instead of a joyful match, into proof of its claim over Jerusalem. And the Palestinian government, basically matching them, has turned it into evidence supporting their claim that Israel's sovereignty over all of Jerusalem is in doubt. It's important to mention that this the stadium where this match was going to be played is well in West Jerusalem. But if you look at all of the material put up by the Palestinian Authority, every single piece of paper mentions, every post, everything says that the stadium is located on what was once an Arab village and was destroyed by Israel. So everyone is really kind of putting the flames up, I would say.
Noga Tarnopolsky, a reporter living in Israel, speaking with us from Jerusalem. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. It's a monthly fact of life for pretty much every woman on Earth and for a significant part of their lives. And yet menstruation is something that just talking about it makes a lot of people uncomfortable, especially men. But in some places around the world, it's more consequential than just creating awkward moments.
I was reading an article about girls in South Africa who weren't able to go to school because they couldn't manage their periods in school. And this made me so angry.
That's Anna Dahlquist, a Swedish journalist who writes about sexual politics. A few years ago, I heard pretty much the same thing from girls in Nairobi, Kenya. Dahlquist has a new book out called It's Only Blood. She spoke with my colleague Carol Hills about it as part of our Across Women's Lives project.
Around the world, there are millions and millions of menstruators that don't have the material resources that you need to manage your menstruation, like menstrual products or toilets, access to water, to soap, or just to privacy. And if you combine that also with the shame and silence connected to periods all over the world, that means that everyday life becomes very, very difficult for a lot of people in the world just because they're bleeding. And it means that it becomes difficult to go to school, becomes difficult to go to work. It affects your health when it comes to like infections and many other parts of life, like making your own choices and moving around freely.
Give me a few examples of what countries you found this in.
Well, I was looking at Africa, south of Sahara, and in South Asia because I was looking at the parts of the world where most of the people that live in poverty can be found. And I went to Uganda and Kenya, to India and to Bangladesh to interview women and girls describing their experiences.
Give me an example of, say, somewhere you went in South Asia and the particular community and how girls dealt with their periods.
Well, when I interviewed some teenagers in Karnataka, which is in southern India, it was outside Bangalore. And there's one like a big menstrual rule in India, which is that you're not allowed to enter Hindu temples while you're on your period. And I met this 13-year-old girl and she was telling me about, you know, she was going on a field trip with a group of friends. They were going away for several days and she knew she was going to get her period during that field trip. And she wasn't allowed to come if she was having her period. So what she did was that she'd heard that if you buy a papaya and if you eat a papaya, that might like provoke your period. So she'll have her period before this field trip. So she went and she bought a papaya. She ate it all. It didn't work. So she had to stay home. And this might sound like a small thing, but it's not. It is a big thing. It means that she was left out from something that she should have the right to do. These girls also told me that when they had their first periods, they were not allowed to go outside their homes around 2 weeks. They were not allowed to sleep on their regular beds. They weren't allowed to eat on the same chinas as they would usually do. And in parts of India and Nepal, on the countryside, women are actually forced to sleep in menstrual huts during their periods. And these menstrual huts are usually they lack all sort of comfort. There's no electricity, there's no heating, they're very small. And women have actually died in these huts because they've tried to heat them up and suffocated to death. As well as there are known cases of sexual violence when girls or women have slept there by themselves.
What are the interventions one can do without treading into kind of interfering in social practices or traditions?
Well, I think that it's important to see that, okay, this is actually connected to human rights. And I also think that we need to look at it as something that exists everywhere. It's not like a special cultural practice. The idea of shaming and separating and silence and secrecy around periods is universal. It's a global thing. It's not something that is specific for certain cultures. It's also happening in Sweden, where I live, or in the United States, where you live, or somewhere in UK.
Give us an example of those.
I think that we live with rules that we might not think about that much, but we're supposed to keep our menstrual products hidden. We're not supposed to show our tampons and pads. We keep it in a bag or in a pocket. And we're not supposed to talk about it, especially not with men, not a part of a public discussion. And I think, especially when you're a teenager, people making fun of periods, mocking, and ideas that periods is something that is dirty. This is also reinforced in media, in ads, when you sell commercial products. The message is buy this to stay clean and fresh, as
opposed to being dirty and not fresh. So, and this has an effect on the way we look at our bodies and this perfectly normal bodily function that is menstruation. And it also means that we haven't had public conversation around periods. That means that we haven't been able to talk about complications like menstrual cramps, endometriosis, heavy bleeding. And if we don't talk about these things, we cannot demand changes like better healthcare, better research, better menstrual products that are not too expensive that everyone can access.
It seems like kind of normalizing discussions about menstruation and periods, it's sort of having a moment with Meghan Markle, the new Duchess of Sussex, involved, and she and Harry giving money to organizations that are trying to break down taboos and provide tampons and napkins and other things. I mean, do you agree that we're kind of moving forward on this topic?
Yes, there is a menstrual awakening, one could say. And we've seen this global menstrual movement taking place around the world with a lot of activism and NGOs working on the issue and media becoming interested in it. And now what we have to do is to keep focusing on it so it doesn't become something that's just, okay, we're having our menstrual revolution, we're talking about periods, and then it's over, because this is something that we have to keep on talking about.
What is working in terms of this kind of menstrual movement in terms of awareness?
What is working is if you take a holistic view, you have to talk about it. It's education, it's breaking stigma and breaking silence. And if you don't do that, it doesn't help to give out pads or to build a menstrual-friendly toilet. It has to be part of a package.
I'm just curious, the refugee crisis of the past several years, I remember looking at, you know, TV screens and seeing these thousands and thousands of people. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, I hope those women have tampons. I mean, I thought something that somebody might not think about. Did that spark any discussion at the time?
That's a discussion that also have come up in the global menstrual movement. We have to look at this group of people in this specific situation. And the UN bodies and the NGOs realize that this is something that we have not been looking at. And it actually means that women in refugee camps cannot move around. They cannot go outside to stand in line to get food, for example, because they don't have any menstrual protection. So they're not going to want to do that. They might like stain and bleed and be exposed bleeding. So they cannot access water or food because they are isolated.
Anna Dahlqvist is a Swedish journalist. Her new book is a global look at menstruation. Her book is called It's Only Blood. Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, we hear from an anti-government protester in Nicaragua.
I would like to have elections as soon as possible, and I would like to see that the political parties are more transparent in the way that they lead the country.
The View from Managua, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Granada is a lakeside city in Nicaragua known for its graceful colonial architecture and beautiful scenery, but yesterday the city was in turmoil. The mayor's office was in flames. Anti-government protesters set up barricades in the streets. They said they needed to defend themselves against pro-government gangs. This after more than a month of protests against President Daniel Ortega. Meanwhile, the tension is being felt in the Nicaraguan capital, Managua. Roadblocks are springing up in that city, too. Earlier today, I spoke with a resident of Managua who goes by the name Laura Sanchez. That's not her real name. She worries that speaking with the foreign media could put her in danger. Sanchez says Nicaraguans are bracing themselves for each new day.
It feels very tense in the morning. You don't know what's going to happen because usually the scenario changes from one moment to the other. For example, yesterday, Granada was having some areas set on fire. For example, the municipality building was on fire yesterday. And then there were attacks from pro-government groups to groups who were defending themselves. Stores have been plundered. And so it feels like constant paranoia and constant wondering what's going to happen the next day.
So failing a national dialogue in Nicaragua, the demonstrations continue, and I know you've been to some of these demonstrations. They're pretty big. What is it like to move through the streets when those are happening? Like, how many people are showing up?
We walked going through very difficult neighborhoods and areas where usually you wouldn't, you know, walk because you don't know at some point in the day if you're going to be robbed, etc. But during this protest, no one was robbed, not even the journalists who were carrying equipment, and people were all recording what was happening with their cell phones. So it felt very safe. Mm. We feel safe. And the inhabitants of these neighborhoods who are known for being very difficult people, they have actually helped us with water. And they have showed their supports with their signs.
What do you want as an outcome from these demonstrations?
What I would like is that Daniel Ortega finally admits that he's not able to rule a country where, you know, the majority of the population is against the way that he has led during the past 11 years. I would like to have elections as soon as possible to have another government. And I would like to see that the political parties are more transparent in the way that they lead the country. We want peace and we would like not to have more corruption because we've seen the very biggest figures of the government are becoming businessmen and they have conflict of interest.
One resident of the Nicaraguan capital there. We also reached out to Yairince Perez on the story. He helped organize the protests that sparked the uprising in Nicaragua last April. Perez is now in Los Angeles, but he says he'll return to Nicaragua next month. In his Managua neighborhood, he says residents support President Daniel Ortega.
I live two blocks from UNAN, the biggest public university in Nicaragua with about 30,000 students. All the major road to UNAN, there's a blockade there, which the students guard the university that way. So the way to get into my neighborhood is through a back access. But it's really safe because my neighborhood is Orteguista, meaning that there's no clashes between students and neighbors inside of the community that I live in.
So, Yairince, you've described some of these protesters as peaceful, but there have been small businesses that have gone up in flames, that have been ransacked, and life savings have been destroyed in a matter of hours. So, I mean, how far are you as a protester willing to take this?
That's a great question, and I think there's a huge difference between attacking and self-defense. When confronted with the police, where there's a lot of evidence that they'd be using snipers and like AK-47s to shoot, but it hasn't escalated to the level of gun versus gun like it was in like the 70s during the revolution. I think a lot of the businesses that have been up in flames, it's very complicated because the government has used arson as a way to delegitimize the student movements, painting us as incentivizers towards violence, towards looting.
No, I understand. But even if you're saying it's self-defense, I mean, the outcome ends up by being tragic for some bystanders. So are you comfortable if the whole country follows this path?
I think at this point, we are afraid that if we don't keep moving on, there is going to be a witch hunt of student organizers and of community members. We already committed to the long run, whatever it takes, because if we don't, we would be giving up after over 120 people have been murdered. So at this point, we've definitely passed a point of no return. There's no giving up because the consequences of giving up can be even more violent than what they're happening right now.
That was Yairince Perez. He helped organize anti-government protests in Nicaragua. Remember the populist wave of 2016? It was at least partly responsible for Brexit in the UK and the election of Donald Trump, of course. It affected other parts of the globe, too, and maybe now it's Canada's turn. Tomorrow is Election Day in Ontario, the most populous province in Canada. One name on the ballot is Doug Ford. He's the brother of the late Rob Ford, who made headlines several years back when he admitted to using crack cocaine while serving as mayor of Toronto. Doug Ford is running for premier of Ontario. That's sort of like state governor. Heather Malik is a columnist at the Toronto Star. I asked her to describe Doug Ford.
Doug Ford is a populist. He is indeed very much like Donald Trump, like Nigel Farage. He's the brother of Rob Ford. Doug Ford is allegedly his more responsible brother, but I would describe him as a blowhard, a boastful, bombastic kind of person who really does not like intellect, as in reading books. He disapproves of that sort of thing, and he thinks the world is out to get him.
Just tell us, like, what has he done to earn that kind of descriptor of blowhard and bombastic?
He models himself on Trump. He says foul things about women and to women. He once referred to a reporter as a little bitch.
To her face, or?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And he's anti-taxes. He's anti-city. In some ways, I think he's anti-modernity.
So, I mean, how does that backstory fit into what the Ford family claims to represent and be and what they actually do represent?
There's a wide ocean between what they claim to represent and what they do represent.
What do they claim?
This is embarrassing, but I will say that they actually think of themselves as Toronto's Kennedy family.
What has Doug Ford done to kind of really strut his populist credentials? I mean, what has he done to show that he's one of the people?
He's been foul-mouthed in a way that we really don't expect from politicians. He's made vast claims saying he could find $6 billion in efficiencies in the Ontario budget, and we will not get the new subway we so desperately need. There's a lot of things that cities need in Ontario that he will not give us because he thinks of us as an urban elite.
Who are Doug Ford's supporters in Ontario?
They are suburban voters. Some rural voters. Many of them are new Canadians who like him because he said he'd cut the sex education program in junior schools all over Ontario. We have a very good sex ed curriculum.
So I'm fascinated. How broad is Doug Ford's appeal with those immigrants you were just talking about?
It is very interesting because they previously have always voted Liberal. And I think that conservatives have done a very big outreach to new Canadians. Some of them are conservative in many ways, possibly in religion, on social issues. And they've been very much groomed by the progressive conservatives, as they call themselves. And that might be a significant part of his win. But he really has a big base among older, retired people.
And how much will Doug Ford just automatically get the support his late brother Rob had? Will he just get those supporters?
Oh, yes. Doug Ford could inherit the mantle of his late lamented brother, Rob.
So just back to this populist angle here. I mean, how much have Canadian politicians generally looked to the success of Donald Trump, this populist here in the U.S., and taken a page from his playbook? I mean, it sounds like you're saying that's the case with Doug Ford, but is this a trend in Canada?
No, it's not. This populism in Ontario is a new thing. We hadn't seen it before, and after enduring Rob Ford, Mayor Rob Ford, we thought we'd never have to see it again. I think people feel very resentful. They care a great deal about money. There's great status anxiety. In a time of economic anxiety, people care a great deal about that.
Canada did not have the same economic kind of collapse that the U.S. did in 2008 and 2009. So where does this appeal come from?
I think it's always been there, but it wasn't considered socially acceptable. Before Trump and his ilk came along, and in a way, Trump has been a model for the world in a very sad way. I never thought that Ontario would vote this way. I hesitate to blame Trump for everything, but you made space for a person like that.
Heather Malik, a staff columnist with the Toronto Star, speaking with us from Toronto. Thanks very much, Heather.
Thank you.
There's been a major development in the civil war in Yemen. A major port on the Red Sea, Hodeidah, is surrounded by government fighters who are ready to attack and drive out the rebels who hold the city.
And Marco, we've been talking with people inside Hodeidah.
The World's Stephen Snyder follows Yemen for The World.
Two people from Hodeidah got back to me this week.
Hello, Mr. Stephen. I will talk to you about the situation in Hodeidah. There was yesterday airstrike.
That's an aid worker named Hanadi. She says security has got a lot tighter in the past week, and it's very hard to talk about.
People feel scary, and the strange movement in the street. Military vehicles covered all the street.
We also talked to a businessman there, Abu Yaslam.
I have lived in Hodeidah for a very long time, and I'm married. I got one son.
And he works at the port. He works at the seaport at Hodeida. And the seaport is really the center of this whole thing. Without the seaport, the Houthi rebels who took over Yemen, they would not be able to run their government.
Right. I mean, this is a deep water port, as I understand. So all the goods and supplies come through this port.
Well, they used to until they were embargoed by Saudi Arabia.
Right.
This, many people believe this is an attempt by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to once and for all finish off the Houthis by cutting off their source of supplies.
So tell us more about this businessman, Abu Yaslam.
He works at the seaport, and he says getting to work has been very difficult.
For example, now, whenever I drop by or whenever I go to work by my car, I get checked at each checkpoint, Houthi's checkpoint. So they stop me, they check my car, they check my bag and everything in the car, every day like this.
He is very irritated by the Houthis. He's been living under occupation by the Houthis for 3 years. A few weeks ago, the seaport was hit by an airstrike from the Saudi-led coalition.
There was an airstrike, and it was hitting the port, and we were working. So since these Houthis have entered our lives have been changed to the worst.
And Stephen, is this businessman blaming the airstrikes on the Houthis?
Yes, and the Houthis don't even have any airplanes.
So he's really angry at the Houthis.
Yes, he is. And that brings us to what's happening now. The city is surrounded by government troops, by militias, by fighters for the United Arab Emirates, by fighters loyal to a warlord. All these different groups are surrounding the city, and they want to get the Houthis out of Hodeida. So tensions there are very high. Hanadi, the aid worker I talked to you a minute ago, she says that her family, which lives in another city in Yemen, are urging her to leave.
My family all the time says that we have to move because the news is very bad and most people travel to their villages. Our neighbors here travel to Aden. My uncles, my cousins, all of them travel. People here very scary. When you see that the airstrike very strong and near to the people, they start feel fed up and they think to move from Hodeida.
So the city is totally emptying out, she says. And she says also that she is ready for a siege. She knows what to expect, mostly because she's prepared by what happened 2.5 years ago when the port city of Aden was invaded.
When I contact with my friends in Aden, she told me that there wasn't enough food. They couldn't eat for 2 days. Also the water. There is no light, so we provide our home with light, with the weight, sugar, salt, everything that we need.
So what's she planning to do with this imminent siege?
She's an aid worker, and she says she's going to stay put, and she's going to do whatever she can to help if there's a humanitarian effort afterwards. Abu Yaslam, the man we were talking about, he's getting out. He's taking his family. They're going to go away on a business trip south to Aden for 20 days. And he says he's hoping that there isn't a battle, but if there is, he'll see what happens.
Really, I cannot tell you exactly which party is going to win, but we hope that peace comes back again. If the war broke out, I think we will delay. Yes, I will delay returning from Aden. It will be very risky if I go back to Hodeida.
What a dilemma. So, Stephen, what happens now as this siege begins to start?
Well, right now, everybody's being held off. The United Nations has been negotiating with the Houthis. At least we've heard reports that that's going on. The United States is credited with telling the United Arab Emirates to hold off and let's look for a diplomatic solution. But everything is pitched up very, very high. So we're going to be watching over the next few days.
The World, Stephen Snyder, with that update on what's going on in Yemen. Sounds like we definitely will be staying tuned. Stephen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The planned summit next week between North Korea and the United States is big news for China. China and North Korea have shared history. In the early 1950s, they fought side by side against the U.S. military in the Korean War. China still shares a land border with North Korea. That means China would be the first to feel the impact if there's a conflict or upheaval on the other side of that border. The outcome of the Trump-Kim summit could also lead to changes for the U.S. military presence in Northeast Asia, and that could have an influence on long-term U.S.-China relations. David Rennie is a new Beijing bureau chief for The Economist.
The Chinese are very happy it's taking place. They were complacent for a long time about North Korea getting nukes because they figured the North Koreans weren't about to attack China with them. But it got very rough last year. You had a lot of tests. You had a lot of missiles being tested, a lot of nuclear devices being tested, and they figured it was getting out of hand. And they're very glad to see the only two people at the top of these two regimes, Donald Trump, Kim Jong-un, who can sort this out. China's got some nice, generous motives wanting this sorted out. They don't like having rogue states with nuclear missiles. They also have some quietly selfish motives. They would quite like to see a deal which leaves fewer American troops on their doorstep in South Korea. But they're watching carefully, and they've been guiding the North Korean leader about, I think, how to handle Donald Trump, because he's been twice recently to see the Chinese leader.
And how are those stakes for China coming up in state media there in Beijing?
It's a fascinating thing. So China obviously has a very strictly controlled state media, despite the fact that if you talk to Chinese officials, they admit that relations with America are on a whole range of fronts, from trade wars to security challenges in the South China Sea. They're pretty rough. If you read only the Chinese state media, the papers and the TV pictures that Chinese people see, you don't really get a hint of that. The propaganda machine is being pretty gentle on Donald Trump. They don't really criticize him. And a ton of ordinary Chinese people, they've got a pretty positive image. They think he's a big, successful, rich American businessman. He's tough. He knows how to get stuff done. And I think what people read into that is the fact that the Chinese propaganda machine is being gentle with Donald Trump suggests that the Chinese government is still hoping to do a deal with him. So they don't want to denounce him and then have to explain to their own public why they've just done a deal with someone that they were bad-mouthing. So you can sense they're kind of keeping their powder dry.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So do you see Chinese fingerprints on the events on the on the Korean Peninsula? Are they doing anything to kind of make the outcome of the summit a success?
Well, you see, for the moment, they're still controlling this. You know, the sanctions are being enforced. I think that the real crunch point will come when we know what sort of deal is done at this summit, if a deal is done. Because if, for example, the summit doesn't go well, in the kind of worst case where Donald Trump walks away from the table and says, I can't deal with this guy, he isn't serious, I want much tougher sanctions, we're going back to maximum pressure, every Chinese analyst and official that I have spoken to is absolutely clear, China is not going to go back to much tougher sanctions. They think that now Donald Trump is down this diplomatic path, that's the path that has to run now. And they're not going back to strangle North Korea to help Donald Trump out.
I mean, that kind of plays into the whole narrative of China taking on the mantle that the United States seems to be shedding at the moment, of kind of world stature.
It's a fascinating thing. So I left China after a first posting here 16 years ago. Back then, the America-China relationship was a big deal. But basically, you know, America was still much, much more powerful, much larger economy. And so the question was China going to become a bit more like America as it got richer? Was America going to try and contain China? So those were, you know, people talked about convergence and containment. Coming back 16 years later, the word that everyone is talking about is competition. Economic competition, but also military security competition. And you're right, Marco, a competition for who gets to set the rules for the 21st century. And there's a sort of mixed feeling here that Chinese officials are quite open, that they have plans to, you know, spread their wings, to try and set some rules for the global order. A slight sense when you talk to some of them that it's this opportunity to really step up and fill a vacuum left by America has come sooner than they were expecting. And some of them will say maybe too soon, maybe they're not ready. So it's a very strange moment.
So let me just ask you one thing about that. I want to end on a negative note here. But Professor Graham Allison has pointed out that historically, when one power is rising and another is falling, there's a high probability of war. I mean, just this week, we almost had an incident as a couple of U.S. B-52s flew over one of those artificial Chinese islands. What are your thoughts on this high probability of war idea?
So one of the pieces of good news is that the Chinese read Graham Allison too. So this famous book of his, The Thucydides Trap, you know, quoting this example from ancient Greece, Chinese people talk about the Thucydides Trap all the time, and they don't want to fall into it. So I think if your worry is that people might blunder into a war because they don't realize how high the stakes are, don't worry about that. This is a moment where people are suddenly very conscious of how high the stakes are. And although China is very, as you say, swaggering, absolutely true, they're still really focused on getting rich. They're still really focused on lifting people out of poverty, fixing their own domestic problems. And so what's really striking is you can talk to Chinese officials and Chinese academics and business people about, you know, the big international questions like Trump and North Korea and stuff. But there's often a sense that they would like to get back to what they were planning to do, which is to clean up the air, clean up the water, get peasants, you know, into jobs that pay them a decent living. They've got a lot to do to modernize this country, and the world is calling them, but they're not quite ready to devote all of their attention to that.
David Rennie, the new Beijing bureau chief for The Economist, thank you very much. Good to speak.
Pleasure.
Now, before the meeting takes place, a word of advice for both Trump and Kim. Remember to breathe.
Remember to breathe. I'm begging you, please. Walking round the city at night, it's obvious to me.
Remember to breathe, I'm begging you, please, sings Daphne Guinness on her new album. Yep, Daphne Guinness is the direct descendant of the founder of the Irish brewery that makes a famous stout. But Daphne blazed her own path in the world of fashion and modeling. She's walked down runways around the globe and appeared on fashion mags. So perhaps no surprise then that Daphne Guinness went glam rock when she decided to dive into her first love, music. Guinness teamed up with Tony Visconti, the former record producer for David Bowie. Bowie liked Daphne Guinness so much, he made the connection. The result? Daphne and the Golden Chord. We'll close the show today with the tune Riot from her new sophomore CD. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you all tomorrow.
It's a riot, such a riot. I read myself the Riot Act. It's a riot, such a riot. I can't deny it, cause it's a fact. It's not prophetic, it's just
prophetic. PRI, Public Radio International.